this is Beyond the Barracks, a podcast about the many and varied journeys of Australia's ex-service men, women and their families, brought to you by RSL Victoria.
In each episode, we'll interview a guest, sometimes two, about their life in service and life after service, exploring the many highlights and challenges that they may have faced along the way.
Beyond the Barracks is a podcast for veterans and their families to tell their stories. Sometimes we may discuss experiences and issues that some listeners may find distressing. Please check the show notes for support services.
We acknowledge that this podcast is being recorded on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation and pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. RSL Victoria and the Beyond the Barracks team recognises the service of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, just as we recognise the service of all Australians. We are proud of the contribution they have made and continue to make to the Australian Defence Force.
So, Harry, today on Beyond the Barracks, we have Mark Wales joining us. An impressive CV he's got, and I'm just really looking forward to hearing his insight into his SAS journey and beyond.
Yeah, the survivor, reality TV, author, yeah. And he's writing a book at the moment, you know.
Another one.
Yeah, so he's trying to keep that hush-hush, but I've just blown his cover. But a ripping bloke, you know, with a great background and a great story. Mm. There's a lot of layers to Mark. I'm really looking forward to it as a mate and just as an observer and listener.
And become a family man. So I think, as you say, many, many layers to uncover.
Looking forward to it.
Yep. Thank you for joining us on Beyond the Barracks. I'd love to know just an insight into your background. Where did your childhood start, and how did it grow into becoming part of Australia's most elite military operations?
I've shared this with Moff a couple of times, in barracks or overseas. But I was West Australian born, so I grew up in Newman, up north in WA, and I had my whole childhood was kind of through the 80s. So it was a funny period in Australia, you know, big hair and a lot of good pub rock. But I remember just being in country towns. I was in Geraldton, Perth later on in my life. But we just had a bit of a free-range childhood. I had two brothers, and my parents just let us do whatever we want. So we were out misbehaving most of the day. And you kind of had to, because there was nothing much else in those parts of the world in WA. It was a pretty tiny population, but a lot of beautiful country. So that's how we grew up. And then going to school in Perth when I was about grade 9, that's when I first heard about these specialist army units, and in particular the SAS. And I thought, oh, that'd be good. But I had no idea how to get in. And so I remember I called the guardhouse at the Campbell Barracks.
I might have been on
guard. You might have been on duty. Like, who's this idiot calling me? And, I remember asking him, well, what do I do to get in the SAS? He's like, I'm not telling you anything. I don't know who you are. And so that's kind of how I got started with an interest in it anyway.
I mean, I thought I read somewhere maybe that as a child you wanted to be an astronaut. Is that correct? And clearly you didn't go down that path.
Yeah, the old career choices back. This is during the shuttle program back in the 80s. So astronaut was a pretty good career path for a lot of kids. But, yeah, I remember thinking that'd be fun, and still haven't outgrown it.
And did you have a sense of the sacrifice and the work that you'd have to do to get into the special forces, whatever you perceived it at that stage?
Well, I don't know if you remember that type of period. There weren't many modern books about the SAS. It was just a handful, and then Bravo 2-0 came out in 1993, and that centered around the first Gulf War, and that was – it was a pretty good story. I mean, now when I read it, having some military background, you realise how much of a mess it was. Mm. But that's the first kind of modern book on the SAS. And before that, it was mostly you heard a bit about them from World War II and a bit about them from the Falklands and a few other conflicts, but that was it. And the Aussies in Vietnam. But it was secretive. There was no internet back then. You couldn't just look up the SAS. It was super hard to get info on.
That's right. I remember I just thought, well, I'll get in the army and they'll sort me out from there, you know. And you went to officer training at Duntroon or ADFA in Duntroon, or what was your officer path?
Yeah, it was ADFA, because I thought I'll if I join the army, I'll try and go through the officer track because at least I'll get an undergrad degree. And you know, if I don't get in the regiment, then I can, you know, take my history degree and go mm-hmm. teach kids history. Yeah. But that was it. That's how I kind of joined the army.
So I just want to know, I mean, in your mind, what was it? What did it mean to serve? I mean, was it patriotism? Was it a personal self-challenge? What lured you in that direction?
It just looked like the best job ever. Like the whole, like every young kid, especially young boys, want to be involved in a team and do good things and adventure. And that just seemed to encapsulate all of it. And so it was something good too. Like I felt like there were kind of, that'd be the good guys, and you could join that that aspect of it as well.
Mm. It certainly was exciting. Always had that allure. Yeah. I remember I saw, and you've mentioned this as well, the Iranian hostage siege in London at Pincer's Gate, and those evocative images. You know, I grew up in when things were in black and white, and so the front page of the newspaper and a grainy little box in the corner, that was motivation enough. And so you went to officer school. When was the first contact point? Or were you asking straight away, or did you find what you were looking for in the early stages of your army career?
No, it was terrible because I went there and there was it wasn't a real military training establishment. You do your undergrad degree and you walk around in uniform and then you do a bit of military training on the side. So I was sitting there going, what have I done? I was impatient to kind of get to the good stuff. But I think the good thing about it is I was pretty young. I was only 17. So you need a bit of time to kind of mature and just, you know, let your brain develop a bit. But by the time I'd gotten through all that training, it was 4 years really, by the time you do ADFER and Duntroon. So about 21 when I left and then went to the infantry battalions up north.
Townsville,
yep. 2RAR, and then the team war deployments had started. So we did a deployment.
So this is late 90s.
This was 2001.
Okay,
So you deployed early to East Timor first.
Yep.
That was your first deployment. What was that like?
It was awesome because I'd been overseas. I'd been to like India and a few places, but to see Timor, which was a stone's throw from Darwin and the condition it was in, I just couldn't believe it. I'm like, this is one of our neighbours and they're in dire straits. Just some of the people that were coming back from the internment camps, not internment camps, but the refugee camps in West Timor were just in a horrible shape. Mm. So it was a real shock to me. I couldn't believe that. I thought, you know, there are places that do it a lot rougher than we do.
And what about your first experience as a leader, as a young officer leading a contingent overseas? What form did that take, and you know, what do you reflect back on that as?
Mate, they give us time as platoon commanders at Duntroon, and you just try and keep your head above water because there's a lot to think about.
Yeah.
And then when I went to the infantry battalions, the first thing they did is send us to Tully, the jungle training centre.
Good.
I was scarred. Yeah. I was scarred by it.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Because I don't know what that is.
So Tully is like a very dense North Queensland jungle. And it's horrendous. It's just the worst type of environment you can try and live in, because mm-hmm. The insects and the heat and the close country. And so trying to lead a platoon in that type of country is just exhausting and difficult. And so it was good exposure to all the stuff that goes wrong when you're exposed to bad weather and bad terrain. And then so by the time I went to Timor, at least I'd made those mistakes and, you know, done all the stupid things you can do and you kind of learn your lessons.
The Tully Ales will probably send a shiver down a lot of infantry and other corps spines as we talk about it, the Jungle Warfare Training Centre, where I would suggest the first real nights out bush any infantry soldiers will do is in the jungle. It's a tough environment. I found it the toughest environment by far to operate in, and I can't even imagine fighting close quarter warfare in the jungle. It's pretty crazy. You go to Timor. So you felt well prepared by the time you get to Timor and dealing with what isn't a classical warlike operation. It's a peacekeeping.
Yeah.
It's a you know, kind of the sheriff in town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, and I give credit to the company commander that I had and my platoon sergeant. My company commander was Simon Stewart, who's chief of the army now, And he said to me, he goes, when I was doing the training and you do your officer's basic course in the infantry unit, he goes, every chance you get, go and do orders and get good at developing and presenting your orders to your team, because it's a hard thing to get good at. And he goes, just do it all now, make all your mistakes now. And so I did that. And anyone who's in the army, like, just put yourself in those positions, because that's how you kind of get better at it in training, is just making those mistakes. And so by the time we got to Timor, yeah, we were pretty well formed as a platoon. We'd been through a lot of hard times. And
great.
Yeah, we were in good shape.
You'd have fond memories of the platoon keep in touch with those guys?
Yeah, there's still a Facebook group out there. You know, we had boxing nights and bloody battalion sportos. Oh, mate, it was good fun. You know what it's like? Yeah, it's good.
Did it sort of whet your appetite for wanting more deployments? Was that part of the lure to serve at that stage for you?
Oh, we were lucky, because we walked straight into deployments that were pretty unheard of in the Australian Army kind of leading up to that. There were some deployments in the early 90s, but not that many really. We'd been through a long stretch of peace after Vietnam. Mm. And I just happened to join at that point where we were starting to get busy. And when I was at 2RIR, I heard about all these guys that were in recon or pioneers that had gone to SAS. You heard about them because they were kind of – people talk about them in the battalions. You know, remember, you know, Wayne Jones, he went to – you know, off he went. And so I'd hear about all these guys that went and did selection and kind of what they'd done in the battalions. And I just remember thinking, oh, it might be possible to get there from here.
Very possible. That's where most of the recruiting was coming from at that stage, and still is. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And at what stage were you thinking, I really want to get serious now with the SAS? Like, I want to start the training process and really working your way? Because, I mean, that's a rigorous process, is it not?
Yeah. I had my eye on it from the very start, but I didn't. And that's why everything I did was trying to gear it towards experience as a ground soldier, like a foot soldier. But when I did a second deployment to the Solomon Islands, and I met a guy over there called Nick Conan, who was a captain at that point, and I talked to him. He was an SAS guy. I remember talking to him about it. And I said, oh, I might take another year of playing footy and then I'll go do selection. He goes, don't do that. He goes, the planets will never align. Just go do it now.
Yeah.
And that was good advice. You know, he just goes, you're never going to be fully ready. Just go now.
Mm.
He's still kicking around like a bad smell. Yeah. But so you decide to take advantage of the window. Mm. How old are you at this stage?
I think I was 24 at that point. I was pretty young. Yeah.
It's a good. I think it's the start of the good age. The start of the curve for a good age. You know, mid late 20s. I think
because it takes a couple of years, like the Rio and all that. So by the time you get through it all, then you kind of chew it a bit more.
I think, you know, I always used to say, I think the guys who fared well, particularly in Rio, where it's just, you know, you're kind of biting off more than you can chew day after day. You know, if you've had lost your first love, crashed your first car, hopefully survived that, you know, made your first bad loan or dodgy loan to a loan shark, you know, you've had some of those social
life experiences.
And it's not often talked about. It's often straight to the muscles and the mental skills. Mm. But, I think it sets you up well.
Mm. What is that training process like? Can you give me an insight? I'm curious to know how rigorous it is.
Yeah, so once you get through that, there's like a three-week selection course, which is a really hard gate to kind of get through. If you get through that, there's a reinforcement training cycle, which goes for over a year. When I did, I think it was 18 months.
Right.
Don't know what it is now. I think it's probably something similar still. But in that's where you get all your training, all your specialist training to become – I guess, a special forces soldier. So working in close country or heavy weapons, demolitions, parachuting, all the stuff that you don't have skills in, you get given that on the course. And it's just great. It's just back-to-back fun courses. Some are really hard, but most of it's really good.
So you were just living the dream, essentially, you got through all of that.
You got through.
Never-ending summer kind of experience.
It's just the best, because you've got 25, 30 of your mates and you're going through these courses just you know, it was just the best.
And so finish Rio, then what troop do you go to first?
No, I went to F troop.
Okay, good.
Yeah, two squadron F troop.
Camping with guns.
Yeah. Exactly. And then they shut down two squadron at the end of that year because they were raising four squadron. And then I went to C troop for a year and a half, 2 years.
Yeah.
and then E Troop for a deployment, and then P Troop after that.
And so what was your experience like compared to in the battalion when you first got to RAR? You know, what was the difference? Was it just kind of reset and go again? You felt well prepared to enter the troop?
Just the expectations on your ability to deliver, to lead and deliver on any sort of mission is so much higher, because all the guys in the team are super well trained and they're all experienced, and they expect their troop commanders to be at a really high level as well. Because if they're not, they'll make it pretty clear pretty quickly, and they'll move people on, because there are lives at stake in training and in operations. So it's intimidating is not the word, but it's a huge responsibility early, and you're trying to fight to establish yourself as a reliable person. Yeah.
And how'd you go?
Mate, I got made a few stumbles, but I think as long as people see that you're invested, you're working hard, and that you're going to have a steep kind of learning curve, that's what people want to see. I think when they come across people that maybe think they know what they're doing, or they don't think they've got as much to learn, I think that's when people get concerned. Mm. That was just my experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As a parent, I'm sitting here sort of putting myself in a mother's shoes sort of thing, thinking if my child came to me and said, you know, I want to serve and I want to be part of the SAS, I would be having a mild panic. Very proud, obviously. But what did your parents make of all of this?
Oh, my parents didn't know what to think of it. They're like, because my mum's father had fought in World War II in the Pacific, and it was just this family kind of secret we didn't talk about heaps, but... when I told them I wanted to go to the military, they're like, you know, the military are kind of shit kickers. They're not really – it's not a prestigious job. Uh-huh. But they didn't know anything about the kind of goals that I'd set myself about the SAS. And you didn't really want to talk about it, because it's such a big goal to have. Yeah, you're kind of embarrassed. You don't want to, you don't want to fly your flag too much. But I said, I'm like, no, there's some really good units there. And I'm glad I kind of stuck to my guns. And they, as they saw what I was doing, they got on board for sure.
Yeah, the support was there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think once they see how driven you are to do it, and they probably saw that in you years before anyway, I particularly with my daughter, I kind of think she was toying with joining the military when she went through all of her Defence Force recruiting, and there was moments where I saw this drive and passion in her, and I thought, I love that. You know, I don't care what she does, but I'd love to see more of that kind of hunger in her belly. And I think as a parent... I reflect back now and think if you can reach points where you see that in your kids, that's really satisfying. You know, knowing that they're about it, they're about something.
And the military, I think, it gives you that foundation. You just can't cruise through it. It's just such a crucible that so you never forget your first day in the military. It's
Well, on that, mate, so talk us through some of the most memorable times of your service. You know, it's easy to bracket that with give us your best time, give us your worst or whatever. But, I mean, what really sticks out for you, and share a couple of anecdotes?
Mate, I remember some of the deployments I remember most were towards the end of my time in the regiment, when every year you're kind of getting better at your job. And by the end, I was on a deployment with one squadron. We were over on a rotation to Afghan. I remember joining one of the teams and flying into basically a targeting mission in broad daylight with all the helicopters and all the gunships following us. And I was just there going, this is like very full on, because you know you're going to be landing in an enemy valley and they're going to be everywhere. And I remember that. I remember just going, all right, in 5 minutes we're literally going to be landing in the middle of God knows what. And it's just a
hornet's nest.
Isn't it just such an odd feeling to be flying towards that? You're like, but it's also good because it's everything we wanted to do. Yeah. So I remember that being one really good one. And just a few of the times, I'd always wondered what combat would be like. I've kind of done military history in that. And I think the first real exposure I had to it was in about 2007. And I just remember being in it going, oh, fuck, this is full on. But after a while of just getting into it and calming down a bit, you realise we're really well trained and well equipped to deal with just that kind of basic level of combat that you can find yourself in. So remember that. That was a good one.
I'm dropping big names here in Melbourne, but I was talking to Chris Judd this morning, right?
Nice.
And he was asked a question.
As you do, right?
Yeah, just mulling around. He was asked a question, you know, what do you remember, what do you miss from your time in football? And he said, there's two times I miss. He's obviously thought about it. You know, he said it was the seconds leading up to the bounce. He said between running onto the field and then just getting in the centre square. I don't think he played anywhere in his whole career outside away from the centre. But he said those minutes, and then when the bounce was on, then he says it's all a bit of a blur and mashed into things, right? And then he said the other time, especially after Wynn coming back into the dressing rooms, he goes, those are the two moments. And then I was asked, what do you, and I said, well, I love that, and I'm going to borrow it because that you talked about coming in on the heli. That's the essence of being on ops. It's kind of, you know, ops is every veteran's focus and to the detriment sometime, but there's a whole other career outside of that. You know, how do you compartmentalize your operational self and then your brace, or how do you unpack that?
You mean when we were in the military?
Even reflecting on it, you know, reflecting on it now, it becomes – a lot of veterans kind of get hung up on, have you been on ops, you haven't been on ops, and it's something I try to help some people unpack, you know, that you serve, it's part of your service, but it's not all of your service.
No, it's not. And it's funny because in the lead up to those jobs, it's an unusual one because you know that everything you've learned in your life, you're going to be drawing on in that, you know, hour or a couple of hours you're in battle or whatever it is. But all the work's done and there's nothing else to worry about. It's too late to worry. You're going in and what you've got is what you've got. And I remember enjoying that, but it was hard to compartmentalize. We were going back so much that it just became our life to be over, like going back to Afghanistan and going on jobs. So for me at one point I had all my work was there, all my mates were there. I had a girlfriend there. I'd left equipment there, like my drum kit. So my life was gradually just shifting over to Afghanistan. And so it was it felt like a normal part of life, but it was kind of inverted. It was
– Yeah.
It was – we Australia was unfamiliar to us. We were more comfortable in Afghanistan with our mates.
Yeah. I'd say I phrase it by saying being away was like being at home and being at home was like being away. And it really was a sense. Mate, how did you cope? What were some of the strategies you used to cope during that time? Or I don't want to put a deficit on it, but I mean, maybe at home, how did you cope when?
Well, I didn't have a family at that point, so it was less complicated for me. I'd come home, you know, my apartment, check my mail, you know, make sure the car hasn't fallen apart, and then get ready for your next job. Like that's kind of how it went. And you go down the OBH, and I lived down in Cottesloe. And that to me was a bit of a dream because I always loved the beach and all the guys from the unit were down in Cottesloe most of the time. So just to be able to go down, sit in the water for a bit, it was kind of a healing thing for me for sure.
But cathartic.
Yeah.
I mean, was it an adjustment every time? I mean, you had these kind of very adverse experiences in Afghanistan coming back into normality here, going to the supermarket, the mundane. I mean, how do you readjust to that every single time?
Yeah, it is odd because you're not used to the conventions and the normalities of modern society. And you've also got your brain has basically changed shape during the deployments you've spent. It's kind of overusing your amygdala and, you know, surviving. So you're not fully equipped. I wasn't fully equipped for just day-to-day life. I'd sit there in cafes and just I'd just get sick of it and just think I want to burn the whole place down. It's just like I don't know where it comes from. It's just I had a bad streak in me during that period for sure. Mm. But you kind of need it, I think, too.
Yeah, it is hard because you do need to have that streak in you.
You've got to have it.
Yeah, you've got to be able to suspend almost all rationality in one context. You know, you've got to be highly rational and low emotion, but the rational in combat operations isn't what's rational at home. And also I used to struggle a little with just small things because people ask you about it, but just small things like what are you whinging about? You know, what are you complaining about? And it's all relative.
Yeah.
It, yeah.
So you went back, obviously, multiple times. I think, was it 10 tours of Afghanistan?
That was total. I did like four in Afghanistan. And we do a bunch of small ones. We do these security detachments where you kind of go in and out. But, yeah, full-length tours, it was about four in Afghanistan.
Did you have, like, a yearning to go back every time you came home Australia?
I wanted to go straight back. We would get bored of day-to-day life back home and some of the garbage you got to put up with in barracks. And and when we were working, it was like some of the jobs were great. Like me and Moff lived in a house in Kabul for how many months, you know. It was just bloody great. We did got up to all sorts of mischief.
The two of you lived together for a little while?
We did, yeah.
Yeah, right.
We did some special ops of our own. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Special drinking ops too.
Which is good. I fully endorse that as a psychologist. Don't drink too much. Any more than 24 beers, and you've probably taken the piss. But you talk about that adaptation when you're coming back. We'll get to kind of what's happening for you now and the trend. But that transition period, did you find when you decided, or what was the instigation or the origin point where you said, I've done it, I've had enough.
Yeah,
I'm moving on.
I had most of the time officers kind of have a 4-year posting cycle that goes through a couple of years Rio and then a few 2 or 3 years in the troops. I'd gotten a couple of extra years because I'd gone to a specialist part of the unit. So a lot of my mates had left. I'd been there for a little bit longer, and then I left and went to Duntroon as an instructor for about, it was a 2-year posting. And I'd only been there a few months, and one of the officers at the unit called me up and goes, look, there's going to be a squadron opening up next year. Excuse me. Would you be interested in coming back? And I didn't want to. I was burned out. I didn't want anything to do with it. And I knew then, I was like, well, that's kind of unusual. This is my dream job. And then I started getting some pressure to do jobs in Canberra that were related to our headquarters. And I'm like, I don't want to do it. And I was getting more pressure. And then I started thinking about leaving to go and study. Because I got that idea on that last tour. I'm like, oh, I could go to the US and study. I'd been to New York and I really loved it. And that's when I started looking seriously at MBAs in the US.
Mm. And did you have a sense of what that meant in the long run? Did you have like a long shot, is the job I want to do? Or you just felt intuitively, I'm going to do that and see what comes of it?
I said if you're going to – there's only a couple of things I'd leave a job as good as this for, and one would be a track, which something which gets you on a good track like that, which is a top MBA. I just had no idea what it was going to bring, but I thought there'd be something fun at the end of it all.
Yeah,
I just want to go back a little bit. I'm just interested to understand when it came to your last deployment to Afghanistan. You'd obviously formed an attachment to the country, to the people, to your job, everything. When you knew it was your last time, or did you know that it was going to be your last time, or did that just sort of evolve? You knew you went in. What was that like, knowing that you weren't going to be going back again?
It was funny because you could see the conflict evolving over the years. Like you would have done the really early deployments and it was a totally different conflict. It got bigger and bigger and bigger. More Americans came, more troops. There was more violence, more IEDs. It was getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
The harder we tried, the worse it got. And we were successful as a unit doing our missions, but that, in the scheme of things, it was having no deep impact.
Yeah.
You know, if it did have an impact, it was going to be temporary, right? So I just remember looking at it going, this isn't working. What we're doing is not working. And so I didn't know, I had no idea which direction the conflict was going to go in, but the trend was definitely downwards. Mm. We'd been there for 10 years by that point. It wasn't improving.
And so you felt you had done your time. There was nothing more to give to the mission.
Yep. I'd been in the unit for a while then and was happy that
you were content.
And lucky too, because not very often you get jobs like that.
Mm.
And you had a good run there too.
Yeah.
You know, some officer will come for two years, and then if you're lucky, to come back for another two.
Yeah.
And good too, mate, because I think you know you're highly regarded operator and as an officer. So,
thanks, mate. And that's mate, and it's a huge compliment because it's all you want. You want to be good at your job, and you want people to trust you when you because you know, people's lives are in your hands, and vice versa. But
And you did lose mates along the way, didn't you, Mark?
Yeah.
I mean, surely that has a profound impact. And I mean, is it like a kind of a Band-Aid? You fix it, you kind of work through it, you move on, you go back for more. And that's – at what point did you say, I just can't do this anymore?
It's funny because it's an individual thing, and it's a stoic group of people, and we're strong-minded and we can take losses. But everyone processes it differently, and it's not until I've kind of left and realised, you know, we all wore the same uniform and had the same values. We're all very different people. So it affected everyone in different ways. And I think I remember one of the first fatalities I was in the unit for was the training accident in 2005. Guy was hit by a car and killed in Kuwait.
Dave Neary.
And I didn't personally know him, but everyone I knew him in the unit. And it felt like every year there was a fatality of some sort. It was Josh Porter after that, Matt Locke, who I deployed with and was fighting alongside when he died, and Sean Browning, 2008, Sean,
yep.
Browning 2010. So, and the other guys that died in the car accident. Car so accidents. every year for a long time there were fatalities, and they all hurt. Even if you weren't there with them, you kind of you know, you miss those guys for sure.
And How do you resolve it? You know, how does it feel to be in command of a troop and to lose a soldier?
Mate, there was no training in this. There was no one knew really what to do. It was just because it was unexpected as well at that point. I mean, there'd been. The guy that died, Andy Russell, that died from the mine blast in 2001. Matt Locke, I think, was one of the first guys that died to direct fire. And, I mean, I didn't know exactly how to deal with it. I just got the team. We tried to do more work. We went back. We had a wake for him. Went back to base after the mission was over. We had a wake for him. Had a ramp ceremony. We talked about what we'd done, what we'd do differently. And then we had probably a week to process it, and then we were back into jobs. But it, and I kind of knew too, I'm like, I haven't fully dealt with that, and I'm not going to on this trip, but I know in the future I'm going to have to kind of find peace with it.
Mm. Yeah. And what was that process? How do you find peace? Is it, I mean, how do you deal with mental health after a year out dealing with losses and combat and... Is it talking about it? What do you do?
Well, talking about it's a big part of it, and processing it with peers. I think they've done research on peer debriefing, and it's actually more beneficial to you than, you know, professionals swooping in and having debriefs. I've done some research on that. So talking to my mates about it, who were the ones that kind of understood what we'd been through, and that was an important part of it. But I remember after it going, well, if you're alive and they're not, then you've got to take what you've got and use it as best as you can. I think that's where, after I left the military, I've tried to do as much as I can, which even if it's stuff that was a risk or something I was worried about or something that could embarrass me, I kind of tried to push through that and just go, look, just do it. Like if they were here, they'd probably do the same thing or encourage us. So I think that's kind of how my own – tribute to them, I guess.
Such a nice sort of positive shift on it. I mean, you can have survivor's guilt and all sorts of other things, but you've really kind of pivoted on that and taken it in a positive way moving forward by the sounds of things.
Yeah, I feel like it's that bit of trauma, whatever it is, and it doesn't have to be soldiers. It could be, you know, you might survive a car accident or a sexual assault. You kind of get given a jar full of bloody poison, and you either drink it or you can turn it into rocket fuel and, you know, use it for something good. I think it does stop a lot of people for sure, and I could feel the bad pull of it for years for sure.
And you certainly did turn it into rocket fuel, mate.
Yeah.
You bit off more than you can chew like buggery, as Peter Brock would say. And so left the unit and headed off to Wharton to do, and Preston Klein, by the way. I spoke to him this morning as well.
Nice.
Drop another bomb on you.
Nice.
Yeah, he said to say g'day.
Mate,
and off you went to Wharton. So, you know, what was that experience like? And then living in New York.
Mate, it was it took me about, I think it was a year and a half or 2 years of kind of full-on study to try and get the scores to get to business school. And it was a really quick turnaround. Like I had a decade to think about the regimen, but I only had a short period to focus on this. So I had to work really hard, really quickly while I was doing my day job. But then when I got the acceptance letter for it, I was like, this is a no-brainer. I'm gone. And I was out of Canberra, packed my apartment up, sold all my stuff, packed a surfboard, don't know why I packed a surfboard, and went to Philadelphia, you know. And it was 2 years of full-time study, and I didn't have to work, and I got to rest a lot more. Mm. I got to think about my career and all that stuff, and it was just it was a really healthy couple of years.
Did it help being away from Perth and Australia to help process?
Work through.
The military experience.
I think it did because all of a sudden when you're in the unit and when you've just left, you actually care a lot about what people think about what you're doing or their view of what you might be doing. And I think separating myself from it gave me a bit of an air gap. And I was like, oh, no, actually you might be able to do something, you know, like join a consulting firm or, you know, reality TV. And then it might be unusual and not everyone's going to love it from your old workplace, but who cares? If it's fun, you want to do it, go do it.
Yeah.
So that kind of gave me the courage to do that.
And one more on that, sorry.
Yeah, Yales.
So you're in the US and they love their militarism and Lewis said you would have been an instant fanboy to many or that you would have picked up a few fanboys and girls.
Mate, the good thing about Wharton, and one of the guys explained it to me when I was joining, he goes, mate, we don't take grass eaters here, we take meat eaters. we take veterans here that have done the work. And they were a really welcoming bunch. There was about 30 kind of veterans at the school. And they were all sorts. They were fighter pilots from Israel and, you know, spies from Korea and submariners and a CIA guy. They were really welcoming, good fun. We hung out together and I'm still mates with them now.
Good.
What skills do you think you were able to translate from your service life into then, you know, your studies and making a life for yourself in a foreign country again? And What of the military played into converting yourself?
Not as much as I'd hoped, actually. But no, there was some. I think in the military you become good at planning and kind of project management. So if you're trying to do something that takes a lot of sustained effort over a long time, you can kind of either keep yourself on track or keep a team on track. I wasn't fluent in any of the stuff you need in business, some of the basic technical things from accounting to finance to, you know, statistics. I had to learn all that and it was super humbling because I was the worst in my class at learning this stuff. I had to kind of go back to the bottom. But once I kind of learned those basics and then you've got your skills from the military, which is, you know, focus and work ethic, and those two things are a good mix.
I agree with that. I think it's a real takeaway for anyone listening to Beyond the Barracks. We'll get to, you know, lessons you learned about your career that's helpful, but I'll double click that because the project management skills that you have and the organisational skills, they are concrete.
Yep.
The leadership and, you know, kind of loyalty, those, they're abstract concepts and they're kind of hard to grasp.
Soft.
And what does it mean? Soft skills, yeah. But the concrete, I think that's something everyone could take away, and that's applicable to any, whether it's reality TV, playing in a punk band or running a finance company.
Yep. Yeah.
I think those skills, you know, to reach a goal, you've got to drive yourself forward in an organised fashion.
Yep.
I think that that's perfect.
Yeah, and when you merge the two things, when you do learn those technical skills but you've got all these soft skills from the military, they're a great match.
Yeah.
But it takes time to do that. And they did research on this at McKinsey. They actually, the consulting firm, tracked the performance of veterans when they joined the firm compared to their peers. First 2 years, they're a long way behind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then after 2 years, they shoot ahead.
Yeah.
So once they've learned the fundamentals, all the other skills that they can then apply. To
One thing, I got some advice from a civilian mate who said, just slow down, mate. That's one thing, you know, don't you, I think that's the, We used to
talk
about
game.
Yeah, we used to talk about kind of regional time versus Australian time, but there's certainly a civilian time and a military time. Yeah. So, again, another takeaway, you know, slow down. Mm. You got plenty of time. Don't need to rush to failure. Just but don't lose the ethic behind.
Yeah. And I think be comfortable that the field or the jobs you take on after you leave the military, you probably won't stay in them for long. You may not get it right straight away, and just it's a good learning experience and you can find something better later.
When was the light bulb moment for you to start up a fashion label? Oh, how did that happen?
He's been on the catwalk for years.
Aspiring catwalker. I went to New York and I didn't have many clothes. I knew I was going to be in winter in Philly. And I'm like, God, I've got to get a leather jacket. I always wanted a good one. Couldn't find one. And the more I looked at some of the brands in the US, I'm like, these guys don't have – they don't sell to people like the field that I come from. Mm. So it was a real gap in the market, and I just kind of kept it in mind. And then I presented an idea for a fashion label a couple of times in class, and I was doubting myself. I'm just not sure about this. And then in the second year I was at business school, a friend I had who was really – keen on it, she goes, go and do it now, go and build it, and I'll put it in the fashion show. We'll let you kind of have it shown as a brand. Mm. I was like, shit, and I had 3 weeks. And so I had to go to New York, get a designer and build a kind of prototype in 3 weeks. So I did that, just picked it up the day before the fashion show, and then walked it out. I'm like, oh, this could be something. So we built a website, built a brand behind it, and kind of I worked on it on the side when I was in consulting, and still working on it now.
Yeah, it's still going.
Still going, yeah.
Yeah,
we're about to open a booth up in Las Vegas in January at the SHOT Show. So that'll be fun,
mate.
That to me is just, you know, you can go from SAS to fashion designer. It's just mind-boggling.
Yeah, not only that, and it's going well. It's called Kill Capture. Yeah, and he's got watches and cologne and everything,
whiskey.
Jackets, whiskey, everything going on there. Mate, not only that, Ailes.
There's more.
There's more, and there is more, and I like it. And it's great to have a bunch of irons in the fire. Yeah. And mate, talk us through Survivor. How the hell did you end up on telly with me screaming at the telly going, what are you doing?
Mate, this is a random one, but I'd been in New York for a few years now.
We had a phone conversation around this at one stage, I remember.
I talking about Survivor though?
We a whole bunch of things. Yeah, you were telling me how you could touch all four walls of your bedroom.
Mate, tiny. Yeah. Tiny. New York apartments. Yeah. And I was in there. I'd been cooped up for a few years by now. And I was starting to get sick of being away from home too. I'd been away for ages in the military, and then I'd been away for a few more years studying. And I was with a mate, one of my business school mates. He's a Texan, and he was talking about a mate of his that had done the American Survivor. And he was talking about it. I'm like, oh, that sounds like fun. And then I heard there was an Australian show. And I thought, oh, I'll put my name forward and see if I can get in, you know, be out on a beach. And I probably won't get it, but I'll just see what they say. And I submitted the form, and they wrote back and go, oh, can you do a Zoom call tomorrow? I was like, oh. I was nervous. I didn't want to – you don't do TV stuff when you come from the military like we have. But I went through the process anyway, and I thought, oh, I'll do this. I've got no idea what's going to happen, but eventually got accepted to the show, and I tell my boss, I'm like, look, I need a month off. He goes, what are you doing? I'm like, going on Survivor. He's like, oh, great. Yeah, I love Survivor. Go, you know. And so, off I went and went and did the first show in Samoa in 2017.
And what was that experience like? I mean, did you feel like you were going back to your – military days sort of thing, fending for yourself?
No, it was so bizarre because I remember you land on the mats on day one, like they keep a scenario going, you can't talk to anyone, you don't meet your mates. And then on the first day they walk you onto these mats and you do the first challenge. And there must have been like a couple of hundred people lining the all the crew and everything. And I remember sitting there going, well, this is going to be full on. And we started and it just ended up being a really fun experience. And it was like being in the military, but you know, you're creating something. It's not a military operation. It's just totally different, but it's still good fun.
Mm.
And you wrote a book called Survivor as well.
Survivor, yeah.
And when did that come to you, mate? Because you picked up – sorry to ask a question, but you mentioned that you don't come out of the SAS and go and do a reality TV show and you don't do that. You don't come out and write a book as well, but talk us through the thinking there.
Yeah, well, that was a good thing. Once I'd done Savara, I'm like, well, I can't embarrass myself any further, so I might as well just do a book. But I'd thought about it. I'd always wanted to. I'd always done history and read. I always loved the SAS books and wanted to write about my own experience. But after Survivor the first time, I went home and I read On Writing by Stephen King. It was a really good book and I thought, I should really try and write something. And I kind of sat on it for another year and then I met an editor at a publishing house. He had his own podcast. And I was telling him about it. He's like, just write a proposal and give it to us. And so I did that and they accepted it and said, yeah, if you want to do a book, let's do one.
Did that come pretty easily to you? I mean, just sitting down and just nutting it all out?
I did the outline for it and I remember it was a good – I remember the outline going, I'm like, I can fill these gaps in okay. But I remember as well, I'm like, I'm going to have to be quite honest about the good things but also the things I did terribly because then you'll believe, you know, it's a bit more – bit more authentic, I think. So, yeah, it took me about a year of kind of playing around with the manuscript and then maybe I think another year of editing. And then that came out, I think, 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
I take my hat off to you, mate, because I've always believed that you should follow what you want to do. Whatever energises you, I'm a big believer in managing energy, not time and all the rest of it as a human. But I think if you go out and be seen and do it well, which I think you really have done really well, mate, all of that stuff.
Thanks.
I think that it's a great role model for everyone. The modern world is no longer the days where the old SAS was like, shut up, go away, go down south, turn into a letterbox at the end of a driveway on a country road and shut up. And I'm sorry to offend any of the old guys, but it's just life's moved on and you've got a young family now and other responsibilities and there's so much to do in life, you know, so much to be engaged in soon.
Yeah, and some of it's selfish, like I wanted to tell my own story, but there is another component to it where you are helping a lot of people that have either been through something similar or want to go to the SAS or, you know, that story can really be handy to them as well.
So, 100%.
Yeah.
I mean, I think everything that you have been through in your life, everything that you've achieved has been life-shaping, life-changing, including, I mean, your time on Survivor, you met your now wife.
Yep.
Yeah.
Pretty lucky.
Random.
Yeah. Just, you go on.
Well, the odds are low. There's only 20 of you on the island.
Exactly. Not much to pick from. Wasn't the Bachelor show, you know.
Yeah. I just feel sorry for Sam, you know. It was a pretty low-quality
Low-quality field, yeah.
Yeah,
it was funny. It just one of those lucky surprises in life where I kind of did something I really wasn't sure about but kind of stretched into it anyway and ended up making one of the things I'm most proudest of in my life, which is Sammy and my family and the little boy, Harry. So, very lucky. And then we got to go back again, do it again
round
as husband and wife.
Yeah. what has the journey into fatherhood been like for you and what kind of – I don't know, values and lessons are you trying to instill and war stories are you prepared to impart with Harry?
Yeah, it's the thing that surprised me about it is it's another chance to kind of live life a second time because you've got this person that everything is new again, like first time you go to the beach and the first time you see the moon. And it's just a really cool thing to have. You remember what it's like being a kid and you get to go back and do it again with another kid. And it's just the best thing. I think whenever I'm in doubt about what to do, I always err on the side of being with family, spending time with them, and you know, you never regret that. I think the jobs will come and go, but that's the big one.
You probably noticed tears in my eyes. That really just struck a chord out of everything we're talking about. It just comes back to family. Yeah,
it does.
I mean, doesn't he shit you? He's just a top bloke. He's done all this stuff too, and he's the bloody father of the year as well.
Yeah.
Turn it up.
Wow.
We're close on time, Ailes. Mate, I ask you to give a bit of thought to some mad jungle tips and a bit of, you know, gold dust to sprinkle on the microphone there.
I did have a think about this because you were asking specifically about tips for people who are either going to discharge or in discharge?
Yeah, in both, you know, that are in that transition phase. You know, once you think about it, you're in the transition phase. Yeah. You know, you might be 20 years off, but, you know, I talk a lot about now having the plan B, which is obvious, but drumming it into people's head, you know.
Yeah.
So what are you thinking about? So if you're a young Mark Wales at 25 back in ADFA, it's about to embark, what words of wisdom would you give part to, you know, prepare for the future and what transition and life after?
So I think the big one is understand why you went to the military and understand at what point you'll have achieved what it was you went there for in the first place. Because if you kind of don't pay attention to that, you might find yourself on the track for a lot longer than you intended. Mm. And there's a cost to that. You could have gone and had another career or done something else. I think sometimes we join the military and we think, oh, we've just got to keep going up on this track. But if you stop and think about it, it might not be what you really want. Mm. And I found that about myself. I'm like, what am I doing? The reason I joined was to lead a team in combat, and that's come and gone. And from now on, it's going to be Canberra and bloody these other deployments. And that's not denigrating anyone else, but it's just my personal reasons for joining. It kind of come and gone. So that was one. Just remember why you joined and think about at what point you'd like to leave. I'd say a couple of things, I think, just practical things. If you know you're going to leave and either be employed or go into business yourself, start early with small things like, and this won't seem obvious why in the early stages, but raise yourself a Australian business number. Buy your domain name for your name. So if you're harrymoffat.com, buy that, put it aside. Put a landing page on it, have an email collector, and just have that open so that after a year or so, Google will register that as a website. And the reason all that's important is because eventually when you go into business or you're working for someone else, you might want to do your own thing at some point. And if you slowly build that kind of profile and those assets, it's a lot easier to switch over and then use that to either run a blog or a podcast or sell something or write a book. So just have that set up as a side piece so that if you're in a 9-to-5 working for someone else, you've got this other project on the side you can build on and eventually kind of launch to that as well. So that's one. And another is, and you're good at promoting this, Moff, but have a sport or a community outside the military that has nothing to do with work. It doesn't matter if it's surfing or cricket or whatever it is. Have some other endeavor that has no link to your profession, because I think it's just good to have something that's not tied. Your success isn't tied to it. You can have something totally separate that's enjoyable and kind of fills your cup every day.
Yeah, it's perfect, mate. The mine was cricket during the regiment. One thing struck me when, you know, being inside the military. Let's take the regiment, this SAS thing out of it. It's about performance and success, and there's a lot of expectations. There's a lot of anxiety, and in a lot of ways, the army is a big kind of bundle of anxious nerves, you know, looking over your shoulder because everyone's being assessed from the moment you walk in. So you have this. You need to be emancipated from the military and an assessment mindset. It's one of the things I go back and talk to the regiment guys now. I said, what part of your job now is to emancipate yourself from assessment and being watched all the time.
Yes.
You've got that mindset or that.
Mate, it turns into a nervous wreck.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah.
And so I would go along to the Applecross Cricket Club. We'd win a flag or we'd win a game and I'd see success in a different way.
Yeah.
And I'd see I'd go, how come we're celebrating like that? Here, and it's you know, unabashed bloody joy. And I always say, well, how come I'm not doing that in Perth back at the barracks, you know?
Yeah.
So you know me, I'm kind of a bit of a loose cannon and kind of run around. But I did, part of the band and part of the stuff, some of the things I did at the unit, which was trying to invigorate, guys, come on, let's not, we're taking ourselves too seriously.
Exactly.
Let's loosen up. Let's just be dickheads for a while and revel in that. And that's great. I think that's a great takeaway. It's a really powerful one. Don't let it be all of you.
Yeah. No, you don't need to flog yourself. Like it's hard enough as it is. You've got to enjoy it.
Mm. Mark, on that note, just before we wrap up, you said you'd obviously have interests outside of your profession, but I'm also curious to hear from you. Did ex-service organisations, ESOs, play into your life at all and to be around people who were like-minded who could understand where you're coming from. Were ESOs part of that at all?
They weren't for me, but it's kind of it was a bit different because I left and went straight to the US. Mm. So I was kind of in their system more so. But if I was leaving now, and I've spent a bit of time in the ESO space with a few different nonprofits, I would definitely lean on them more than I did because I was away in the US. I think there's so much on offer, and it's hard to even know how much is out there. But every organisation has something good to offer that is especially dedicated to veterans. So
definitely a soft landing if you think through it and don't rush out there. But there's it's hard to navigate through. But there's some great organisations and people that can help you navigate.
Yep.
Yeah.
I want episode 2 with you.
Let's do it. Let's do episode 2. I'm up for a sequel.
I'll have to do it from somewhere, some exotic location
in
the middle of the Pacific. But we're happy for you to fly us in, mate.
Oh, right. So, private jet.
Once kill capture goes A-level, we'll be knocking on your door.
Whoever in private C-130, mate.
Mate, I really appreciate your time, mate. Yeah. You know, you're a top-class B-grade celebrity, and you've done the right thing to come in and support the RSL and the podcast Beyond the Barracks. So I really appreciate it as a mate and as a professional as well. So thank you.
Mate, thanks. And I know there's a lot of people that, 6,000 or so every year that leave the military, and I think just enjoy it. There's a lot of fun things you can do and can be tricky at times, but there's a lot of good things out there, and good on you guys for doing a podcast on it too.
Thank you. Ditto what Harry said, and I am officially starstruck. It's done. So thank you.
Oh, turn it up. Bloody great. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks.
You know, again, as I said at the start, not only as a mate, but just as a curious mind. So many parts of Mark and how he's transitioned and thought through his career has been amazing.
And I have to say, I think when you say thought through, that's what really I think struck me is his thoughtfulness in providing some very practical hands-on tips and information about the transition out. I mean, like real detailed examples of what has worked for him.
Yeah, definitely. I loved his analogy of having something outside that's separate to, you know, your profession, vocation, something I've referred to in the past as a third thing. And so that, you know, your service isn't all you are, it's just a little part of you are and processing it along the way. So, you know, there's a little bit of deliberate decision-making that's got to occur, and he's a great example of that.
Mm. I think what also really resonated for me was the fact that he made mention of for servicemen and women to really think about why they joined and where the end of that career is and what the reason is behind that.
Yeah, wasn't that fascinating? He gave the example of, I wanted to be experienced combat and potentially lead individuals in combat, and he achieved that. And then to his true to himself, he said, okay, I've done that, move on. And that way you're not kind of just kicking the can down the road or dwelling in a position because you feel like you have to.
Absolutely. And I think I did say in the wrap-up with Mark's interview that I'm starstruck, but I really genuinely mean that in the most endearing way, because he's so down to earth, he's so real, and he's just a captivating guy that, as we said when we started, has so many layers.
Yeah.
If this podcast episode raises any concerns for you, please contact Lifeline on 13 11 14. If you're a current or ex-service member of the ADF or a family member of a veteran or someone who's currently serving, you can access free and confidential 24/7 support from Open Arms Veterans and Families Counselling on 1800 011 046. Current serving members of the ADF and their families can also contact the All Hours Support Line on 1800 628 036 for confidential support. RSL Victoria is here to provide assistance and support to past and present service personnel and their families. Importantly, you don't have to be a member of the RSL to receive assistance from RSL Victoria. You only have to be a current or former member of the Australian Defence Force, our allies, or a dependent of either group. To access RSL support, you can reach out to your closest RSL sub-branch or contact RSL Victoria's Veteran Central Service on 1300 MILVET, 1300 645 838.